one of the news programs, you know, 2020 or Nightline or one of those types of shows that was doing a story on an exorcism, doing a story about exorcism. The particular religious group that was involved in this exorcism was a Catholic organization. And in the course of telling this story, the reporter outlined what was necessary to happen in order for an exorcism to take place. And of course, the first criteria to be discussed was there had to be a legitimate possession of a person, that there had to be a demon, a spiritual being, that had taken possession of an individual. And so the question would come then, of course, well, how do you know that such a thing has occurred? And they had some definitions of what must be true in order for there to be a legitimate possession. And some of those characteristics that had to be present was that the person possessed had to speak in tongues. That is, they had to speak things that were really unintelligible. It's the very common misunderstanding of what tongues in the Bible really were. And you can look in Acts the second chapter and see, for instance, that tongues that are referred to there were languages, human languages. But in the course of this exorcism that was being televised, the person who was possessed spoke things, they uttered things verbally that were unintelligible. There was no human language involved whatsoever. But this was what was defined by this organization as being one of the characteristics necessary for there to be a legitimate possession. Another characteristic of a possession, as they defined it, was that a person must levitate. They must leave the ground under the influence, of course, of this spiritual being. And there as well must be exhibited superhuman strength. These were some of the qualities that must be demonstrated in order for it to be determined that there is a legitimate possession of this person by a spiritual being that must then be exorcised. Well, in the course of this program, there was a young woman. It was determined that she was indeed legitimately possessed. That is, she spoke in tongues, as these folks defined it. It was interesting that she never really left the ground. She did not leave the ground because she was being held down, as the explanation was given. Otherwise, she would have levitated. She was being held down by two, and I'm saying this as kindly as I can, two elderly nuns. I don't know where the superhuman strength went, or those were two very strong nuns that I would not want to encounter get mad at me in any sort of way. I really don't say these things to make light of these individuals, but just to really to illustrate, I hope, some of the ideas that people have about demon possession and about casting out demons or exorcising demons. And that's what I want to talk to you about this evening, is basically what does the Bible have to say about exorcism, about the casting out of demons, and When we look at that, of course, that's really the basic definition of exorcism. It is to expel, to cast out, or to get rid of something. And in the case that we're talking about, in the Bible, and then claims that are made by individuals as well, it is the idea of there being a demon, an evil spiritual being that has taken possession of a person, that has entered their body, taken possession of them, and now is being expelled, is being cast out. Did such beings exist? Or maybe I should ask the question, do such evil beings exist? Or is this some kind of fanciful idea, some kind of superstitious notion that ancient people had and that unsophisticated, uninformed people may even have today? Do evil spirits exist? Well, I want you to think with me as we look at this from a biblical perspective, just what can we glean from the Bible about this? And if you look with me in the book of Mark and in chapter 3, we'll begin, chapter 3, verses 11 and 12, we find where Mark records this about part of the earthly ministry of Jesus. It says that whenever the unclean spirits beheld him, that is, beheld Jesus, whenever the unclean spirits beheld him, they would fall down before him and cry out, saying, "You are the Son of God." And he earnestly warned them not to make him known. A couple of interesting things in those verses. One being the admonition that Jesus would give not to make him known. We might wonder, why would Jesus not want to be known? And we won't take the time to go into a great deal of discussion about this, but just very quickly, not only did he tell evil spirits this, we see that in the gospel accounts he told people this from time to time. People that he encountered, maybe some who had been sick, that he healed, he would tell them to not make him known. Why would he not want to be known? And I believe that the answer to that, very simply, is that oftentimes such miraculous events, of course, would draw great attention and would draw great crowds, and they would press in upon Jesus. And it really became a hindrance to him in moving about and going from place to place to do his teaching and his preaching. I think in the Gospel of John, if you look through it, you'll find an interesting phrase that appears almost from the very beginning of the Gospel, where the statement would be made that his hour was not yet come. And then as you get to the end of the Gospel of John, a statement is finally made that the hour, or his hour, had come. He was moving toward his crucifixion, his sacrifice. And he was moving on a schedule of his Father's own choosing. He was not subject to circumstances and the schedules of people and just operating at the whim of chance. But as he lived his life and he carried on for those 3 years of public preaching, and he moved about among people, there were times when some great momentous event, such as the casting out of a demon of someone, could hinder his movement from place to place. And so for that reason, he would on occasions tell people not to make him known. And here we see that this was being said of the demons. Or rather, it was said to the demons. But it is clearly indicated, it seems to me, in this passage in Mark chapter 3, that from the perspective of the biblical writers, evil spirits or demons were very real beings. In Mark chapter 1 and verses 23 and following, we find another record that indicates this. It says that just then there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit. He cried out saying, "What do we have to do with you, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." And you go on and you can read in the following verses there on down through verse 28 of in Jesus' life how on this occasion he carried on this discussion with a demon. We'll not take the time to read it, but in Acts chapter 19 and verses 13 through 17, we see in the early days of the church, in the infancy of the church, demons were still active among people. And Luke records them as having been real beings. So as we look at this from the perspective of understanding about exorcism, and how it is the casting out of demons from individuals, we have to first, if we're going to believe the Bible, acknowledge that the Bible presents them as being very real beings. But what were these demons? Well, I would suggest to you that first of all, we can glean from just the verse in Mark chapter 3, verses 11 and 12, that they were described as being unclean or evil, that by their nature they were of Satan. They were aligned with that spiritual kingdom that was ruled over by Satan. But we can also see that they were beings. We can see this by the fact that they spoke. Not only were they beings, but they were intelligent beings. They believed, we've read there in Mark in chapter 1 and in chapter 3, where they indicated their understanding of who Jesus is, that He is the Son of God. In James, the second chapter, and in verse 19, James talks about these beings. He speaks of them as being real. He speaks of them as being of the devil. He speaks of them as being those who are intelligent because he says of them that they believe and tremble. They know who God is. They know who the Son of God is. So these are real beings, evil in their nature, intelligent, capable of believing. They are active. We've seen that they were active during the time of Jesus' ministry. He encountered them, as he did here in Mark chapter 3. We also can see that they were active during the infancy or the early days of the church. Turn for an example of that in Acts the 8th chapter. Verses 6 and 7. Where there Luke says that the multitudes with one accord were giving attention to what was said by Philip as they heard and saw the signs which he was performing. For in the case of many who had unclean spirits, they were coming out of them, shouting with a loud voice, and many who had been paralyzed and lame were healed. Well, we see Philip's work, Philip the evangelist, his work in Samaria, the miraculous powers that accompanied his preaching. And part of those miraculous abilities were demonstrated not only in the healing of those who were paralyzed, those who were physically infirmed in some way, but also in the casting out of spirits. So we see in these early days of the Lord's church, these beings were present among men, active among men and women. So, what are they? Well, there are a lot of questions, a lot more questions, I'm sure, that you might have. I know there are a lot of questions that I have about these beings as to their origins, where they came from. There are a lot of things about them that are unanswered in the Scriptures. If you look in Ephesians, the 6th chapter, In verse 12, I believe we see where the Apostle Paul says some more about these beings. For our struggle, he says, in writing to his brethren, urging them to put on the full armor of God, to be active in the fight against the devil, so that they would be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. And then he says in verse 12 that our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. That phrase, in the heavenly places, appears throughout Paul's letter to the Ephesians. And it seems to me it has a number of different meanings. He talks, for instance, about our sitting, that is, Christians sitting at present with Christ in the heavenly places. It takes on there the meaning of a spiritual relationship, a spiritual domain. It's easy to read that and think, okay, in the heavenly places, it's talking about heaven. It's talking about the place of God. But not always. We sit as Christians now in heavenly places, in a spiritual realm, in a spiritual relationship with the Lord. But in here in the sixth chapter, as we've read in the 12th verse, the phrase is used to describe those world forces of this darkness, those spiritual forces of wickedness in heavenly places. You see, there is a realm, there is a spiritual realm. This world is not the only place that exists. The physical realm is not the only realm that exists. There is a spiritual realm. There are spiritual beings that exist. You think of angels. You think of demons. We can think of Satan. We can think of God, the Holy Spirit, Jesus Himself, even now, exists not within this physical realm, but in a spiritual realm, in the heavenly, what Paul describes here as the heavenly places. And there's a good and a favorable notation about that. There's also an evil element of the spiritual realm. I wish I could tell you more about these beings. But what I can say with certainty is that the Bible presents them as being real, as existing even today. But now, we're talking about the exorcism of these beings. What the Bible has to say about their being exorcised. And I suppose that one question that would come to the minds of a lot of people is, well, why did God even allow these beings to become active and to be able to possess people? I would suggest to you that there was a time when they certainly were not as active as they appear to be when we come to the New Testament. The Old Testament does speak about spirits, about evil spirits, about demons. But certainly when you read the Old Testament scriptures, you don't see them mentioned as much. They don't seem to be as active. Maybe I'm not choosing the best of words in that regard. But there is much more said about them during the days of Christ and the early days of the church. Why is that so? Well, I would suggest to you it is so because they became more active at that time. Why? I would suggest it was by the design of God. They are greatly powerful beings, as I think is demonstrated in many instances in the scriptures. I know that that phrasing, that description we made at the beginning of their having superhuman strength is probably something that's not far from being true. They are certainly superhuman. That is, they are above human. They are other than human. The Bible speaks about their abilities in one instance, describing Jesus encountering a man in Mark, the 5th chapter. It says that when he had come out of the boat, immediately a man from the tombs with an unclean spirit met him, and he had his dwelling among the tombs, and no one was able to bind him anymore, even with a chain, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been torn apart by him, and the shackles broken in pieces, and no one was strong enough to subdue him. I guess what they needed were a couple of elderly nuns there. And constantly, night and day, among the tombs and in the mountains, he was crying out and gashing himself with stones. And seeing Jesus from a distance, he ran up and bowed down before him, crying out with a loud voice. He said, "What do I have to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you, by God, do not torment me." For he had been saying to him, that is, Jesus had been saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." He was asking him, "What is your name?" And he said to him, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And you can go on and read the remaining verses describing the exorcism, the casting out of the demons that possessed this man. But notice the strength and the power that these demons had over this man. Why was this permitted? Well, I would suggest to you, it was permitted basically as a show of power. Whose power was greater? These demons, these spiritual beings, power over human beings, whose was greater? Unquestionably, the demons. What about the demons' power in contrast to that of Christ? Unquestionably, as we've seen in these readings, Mark 1, Mark 3, Mark 5, in all instances, these demons proclaimed the superiority of Christ. They acknowledged His greater power. Do you see what God was doing in this? He was demonstrating His power not only in this physical realm, not only among men, but His supreme power even outside of this realm, even within the spiritual realm, in what Paul described as the heavenly places. There was no power greater than God's. And for this period of greater activity among men, when demons, when Satan's ability to take power over individuals, when that was allowed, God was demonstrating during that time His greater power than Satan's. Mark chapter 16, in verses 17 through 20, we find where, as the Lord speaks about the work of His disciples, as He commissions His apostles to go to all the world and to preach the gospel to all of creation, and those that believe and are baptized would be saved. He who disbelieves will be condemned. But then notice verse 17. He's talking obviously about the early days of the church, that infancy period of the church. He says that these signs will accompany those who have believed. In my name, they will cast out demons. They will speak with new tongues. They will pick up serpents. They will drink any deadly poison. It shall not hurt them. They will lay hands on the sick, and they will recover. Great powers to be demonstrated by the Lord's people. Why was that so during that period of time? It was so to demonstrate God's superior power, including the casting out of demons. Now, are people possessed today? That, of course, is the question that is raised in the minds of many people. Are demons still active? Notice, I'm not asking the question, are they still existing? Are they still real? Yes, they're still real. Yes, they still exist. But are they still active among men and women today? Turn your Bibles, if you would, to the book of Zechariah. In the book of Zechariah, we're reading from the prophet who worked in the closing days of the Old Testament. If you don't know where Zechariah is, Malachi is the last book in the Old Testament. Zechariah is the one right before it. Fittingly so, because they were the last of the writing prophets during that Old Testament era until the time that John the Baptist would come about 400 years later. But these men wrote much about the Messiah who would come during the days of John and the age that the Messiah would bring. In Zechariah chapter 12, writing about that messianic age, Zechariah says that I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication, so that they will look on me whom they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son, and they will weep bitterly over him like the bitter weeping over a firstborn. You can continue on reading. He has described the crucifixion of Christ, the piercing of him, for whom they will then mourn. Now drop down to verse chapter 13 in the first two verses. In that day, that is, in the time of the one who was pierced and mourned, in that day a fountain will be opened for the house of David, for the inhabitants of Jerusalem, for sin and impurity. You get the picture of a fountain that cleanses sins? Now verse 2, and it will come about in that day, declares the Lord of hosts, that I will cut off the names of the idols from the land, and they will no longer be remembered, and I will also remove the prophets and the unclean spirit from the land. He writes about an ending of a time of prophecy, an ending of the time of the activity of these spirits associated with that one who would come, who would be pierced, the fountain open for the cleansing of sins and impurities among the people. There was an age, in other words, that was going to come when the activities of these beings would be brought to an end. We read over in the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 13 where the Apostle Paul writes about a time when prophesying was going to be brought to an end. Prophesying being inspired teaching that was done. And we read in the New Testament about that early age of the church when prophets worked among God's people. But Paul says there's a time coming when prophesying are going to be brought to an end, when the full revelation of God's Word is going to have been completed, when the working of miraculous powers is no longer going to be needed in order to demonstrate God's power. Such a time came. And the activities of such spiritual beings, as we read about, these demons, was brought to an end. People are no longer taken by the devil. Instead, the Apostle Paul writes in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 27, the warning, give no place to the devil. You see, that's the problem. The problem is not that demons are any longer possessing people. The problem is not that the devil comes and takes us. The problem is that we often give place to the devil. The devil's place in us is not taken. It is given. That is mankind's problem today. Sometimes folks will say, oh, but why wouldn't God want to continue to show his power over the demons? Why wouldn't God want to show his continued superior power over Satan and spiritual forces that are aligned against him? Well, let me ask you this. How many times does he have to do it? How long does he have to do it? We might as well ask the question, or at least make the proposition, well, why not have Jesus come back and die over and over and over again to show God's love? How many times does he have to do it? Has he not made the case of his love for you, for me? Has he not made the case of his supreme power in the physical realm by the miracles that he had worked among men and women? And has he not made the case of his power over spiritual forces and the ways that he cast out demons during the life of his own son, the earthly life of his own son, and then the early days of his church? Oh, he's made the case. He's demonstrated plenty of times. The question simply remains is, will we acknowledge him? That his is the supreme power. And that not only must spiritual beings bow the knee to him, but so must human beings. And Paul says as much in the book of Philippians when he talks about the time coming when every knee will bow and every tongue will confess the name of Christ. Everyone. We have the opportunity to choose to do so now. And by bowing the knee and confessing the Christ and obeying him to be saved by him. Because his power is supreme. Even so great that Satan's grip upon our lives can be broken. The sins that he has tempted us to commit can be forgiven and removed from us by the God who is more powerful. Would you allow him to do that tonight? Won't you come to him as we stand and sing?